Today's podcast is sponsored by two of our very own Retromaniacs from the Retro Asylum community, Stotz31 and Mr. Sid. Thank you very much, guys. We really appreciate your generous donations. Hi there, guys. It's time for another pre-podcast announcement. This time I'd just like to remind everyone that you can still win the N64 that we're giving away. Now you can do this in a number of different ways. The first way is you can leave us an iTunes review at Retro Asylum Podcast. If you've left us an iTunes review already, hey, that means you've already entered. Now the second way is you can like our Facebook page at Retro Asylum. And the third way, it's a little bit more difficult but still a bit of fun. At the end of the podcast, I'm going to play three music tracks. And if you know what they are, email me at andy@retroasylum.com. And you can do all three different ways, so you've got more of a chance of winning. So yeah, why not enter the Win on N64 competition? Now next up, the next announcement I'd like to say is, I want to thank Nicola and Anthony Caulfield, the filmmakers of the movie From Bedrooms to Billions. And I'm sure you're all going to enjoy the show as much as I enjoyed recording it, because I had a real blast recording it with both of them. Because they're so passionate about the particular subject that they're talking about, which is a movie, that it really made me want to see the film even more. So I'm sure you guys are going to love this podcast and really going to want to see the movie when it does come out. So yeah, thank you very much, Nicola and Anthony. And anyway, enough of me rambling on. Enjoy the show. So with me today is Nicola and Anthony.
Good morning.
Gracious films. How are you both?
We're very well, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. First things up there, I'd like to say thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It really means a lot because I'm so looking forward to this film.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Right, so for those of you that aren't too sure who Nicola and Anthony are, they're basically making this documentary movie. When is it released, by the way, guys?
Well, we've got a slated release of spring 2013, which we're still very much on course for. So you're probably thinking, is he going to suddenly say we're going to shift it back? But no, we've been working very hard to make sure we can get it out for spring next year. So we've got no reason to shift that at the moment. But yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, and I think every retro gaming fan out there is really, really looking forward to this. So so we can get an idea of your retro gaming histories. How did you first get into retro gaming? Just so we can get an idea of who you are, really.
Well, basically, Nicola and I, we're married now, but we've actually mm-hmm. been together for, 22 years? We met in 1990.
A long time.
That's right. And though we met through different circumstances, quite early on, we both realised that we were very big gamers. And yeah. I think at that time I was coming to the end of my Commodore 64. I think my dad had just bought an Atari ST at that point, a 1040. Mm-hmm. And Nicola was very much a ZX Spectrum 48K fan.
Yeah.
And you're enemies then in that case.
Yeah. But then again, you see, she became an immediate turncoat, which I'm sure the Spectrum fans out there are going to be appalled that actually her dad did a deal with my dad to buy my entire Commodore 64. That included the whole thing, disk drive, everything, because my dad for a very short time worked for Commodore.
He
worked for a company called Music Sales in the early 80s, which produced mm-hmm. that music. I'm trying to remember the full name of it now, he's going to kill me. It was that music center, the keyboard that fitted over the top of the Commodore 64, the music center that
right.
turned Commodore into a music machine because of the MIDI output and everything. So his first day on the job in 1984 to go to work at Commodore, I said, Dad, could you get a Commodore 16? Because at the time, we didn't have a computer at home, and at the time, the Commodore 16 ad was running constantly on TV, and funny enough, it's in my brain now because we're doing all the archive for the movie, and it was £139.99. That was the advert with two schoolboys talking about it. And I asked him if he'd get it, and he turned around to me and he said, Anthony, I don't think on my first day at a new job I'm going to be able to walk out with a computer, don't you? And I said, yeah, and sort of was all And then that night he came home on his first day home on the job, and he said, do you want to come out to the back of the car? And he opened the boot of the car, and inside was a boxed Commodore 64, the monitor, disk drive, and the Melody Center and everything. So
that's amazing. You must have been so ecstatic.
It's absolutely blown away. I mean, obviously, I was a fan of... It was always other people, so friends or family had things like Atari 2600s or even mm-hmm. Spectrum someone had, but I never had a computer of my own until that point, and that just completely sort of blew me away. I mean, what was it with you with the Spectrum, Nick?
Oh, I just absolutely loved it. It was the first computer that my parents got for me, and I would sit there for hours programming, getting the magazines and going through the... you know, they'd have the program in there that you could type in, and I'd spend the whole day doing it, and then run it at the end of the day, and it would never work. But I'd keep going back through it, determined to make it work. But I just absolutely loved it. I loved the rubber keys.
Are you on the 48K?
Yes.
See, as a 16-year-old, when I was 16, and I'm a sort of closet geek, to hear that you're this attractive blonde girl that you would assume would be out sort of in clubs all the time and everything else, actually is a closet programmer. Or, you know, it was just unbelievable. So we sort of, right from an early, you know, right from first meeting, realized we both shared a passion for is the accepted term now. We called them computer games, but is now in terms of video games. And I don't think we were always buying another system and always buying games for it and playing together. Mm. It was always part of it. Though the handy thing was, my dad sold her dad the Commodore 64. When we got married, I got it back. So
I think that's the only reason we got married.
maybe. But wow, isn't it amazing though? Two rival forces, C64, Spectrum, you know, young boy, young girl, they fall in love through this? Wow.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, that's exactly how it happened.
And we've still got both the computers, they're in our loft, and we won't let them go, will we?
No, of course not, absolutely.
That's it, got all the original games.
This is Matt Denaris. When the modern world is taking its toll on me, I tune into the Retro Asylum podcast.
So I think the thing was that this film, I think the sort of the genesis behind it was... Mm. Was literally just came from, as I'm sure many people out there shared experiences through the late 70s and through the 80s of growing up with this with this gear and you know, with these games, with these computers, and whether they programmed or not, or whether they just played the games, I think we all shared a sort of, well, to use the word share about 100 times in the same sentence, we shared this experience.
Yeah.
And as Nick and I went through the 90s, you know, and obviously continued, I think we had a break from games for a little while. I think there was a sort of a couple of years where we just sort of did the sort of going out and drinking
type
thing.
Yeah, we were sociable as well.
I think everyone does that. They discover drinking and so on.
And then I think around 95, I think I got my first PC, which was an Amstrad mm-hmm. PC, 486-66, which blew up. After one day, sorry, Alan, which they did replace immediately. But I think PC gaming came in, and then gradually consoles and all sorts. So we've been very, very close to gaming other than a sort of short break. But we always, and very, very true, we always talked, even through the early 90s, about mm-hmm. that era in the 80s.
Yeah,
I think because once we'd met, we decided that we wanted to be filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Right from, you know, from about the mid-90s, wasn't it? We wanted to do films or tell stories, make documentaries, lots of little things like that. And we invested in our own camera equipment, which I think back then was our first 8mm camera, and sort of did that thing. And that was our main interest of was filmmaking. We had this little list, this little piece of paper, where we said these are the types of programs films we want to make. And at this point, they're all documentaries, and one was like a travel log, and mm-hmm. one was a documentary on ghosts, wasn't it? Which we actually went to Manchester to start filming, didn't we?
Yeah.
But right on the top of the list, right from sort of 1995 or 96 when we first wrote it, was history of UK games industry.
Yeah.
Because we just sort of thought that by the mid-90s, sort of living through it, we sort of felt that everything seemed American and Japanese. No disrespect to the American and the Japanese, but we just sort of thought, what happened? It was almost like, where's the era gone? And I remember sitting there in 97 playing GoldenEye, and actually on the N64 being completely blown away, and obviously knowing it was rare.
Yeah.
There it was on a Japanese system, and it just sort of thought, oh, you know, these guys used to be Ultimate. You know, whatever happened to that industry? So it was one of these sort of recurring questions, and every so often we'd sort of talk about it. And that's why I suppose a lot of filmmakers work, is that it's like, and with any documentary, you tend to start a documentary with a question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? So that by the end of the documentary, you've sort of formed an answer to that, or at least presented enough evidence for people to make their own opinion. So from about, I think properly from about 1998-99, when we actually first started to knock on the door of broadcasters,
yeah,
you know, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, that was on our list, where we were saying, what about a documentary on the British, the UK games industry?
And what was their reaction when you said that then?
It was always no.
Right.
It was. I think
we've always found it hard to get the program placed with anyone because they've regarded it as a niche subject,
yeah,
which we always found quite unbelievable. Really, when you see some of the stuff that's on the channels at the moment, and it's kind of always been a documentary that's stuck with us. You know, we've never ever let it go. You know, it's always like, we will make this documentary one day, by hook or by crook we'll get there. And every time we've gone into broadcasters, we've always tried to peddle the idea, maybe turning it into like a six-part documentary,
three-parters, six-parters,
all sorts of ways to present it to people, but they've just never ever gone for it. And then when we discovered crowdfunding, we looked at that and thought, well, maybe that is the best way for us to make this and do it ourselves, do it how we want to do it and not be governed by a broadcaster.
You're doing this via Indiegogo, is that correct?
Yeah, basically Indiegogo was the best opportunity for us because at that point it was very complex to go through Kickstarter. Now, actually, Kickstarter's opened up to the UK. But at that point, I think it was April, I think when we were seriously looking at going down the crowdfunding route, was March and April, and we looked at Kickstarter, we looked at Indiegogo, and Indiegogo allowed us to, obviously for our UK filmmakers, it was the first choice, and a lot of UK filmmakers and European filmmakers use Indiegogo. But just to sort of recount very briefly about why we arrived at crowdfunding, I mean, we've had some very interesting emails from people that have sort of said to us, almost as if they thought that it's quite interesting, where they go, why have you not tried to get the BBC to make this? Or they're completely shocked that we've not been able to get a broadcast. Now, I'm not going to sort of heap more misery on the BBC. They've got problems today, lately. But I think the thing is going from a broadcaster's angle, I can understand why they find it hard to place. Mm-hmm. You know, the word place means, what audience are we trying to aim this at?
Yeah.
If it's a three-part documentary series looking at the story of the UK games industry, who is the audience? So we obviously tell them, but they look at it and think, well, do we put it on late night on BBC 4? Do we stick it on BBC 2? But I think what we found irritating was the fact that there was just an immediate no, and there didn't seem to be any sort of interest in even developing it further. And I think, as I said earlier, when you look at some of the unbelievably niche material that gets put up almost as vanity projects on channels like BBC 4 and E4, you sort of think, well, why? This is a major, major story in the history of this country. This is not some fad or some, you know, just a little sort of drop in the pan. It really was a major contribution to a massive industry. The UK played a ginormous part in that, a very, very important part of it. And with greatest respect, people, we started to lose some of those individuals. Joffa recently, and you know, there's been people that have started to pass away. Mike Singleton recently.
Yeah.
And you know, with the greatest respect, no one's getting any younger. And we sort of thought we wanted to document it sooner rather than later. And we really did wait a long time for broadcast, because the thing is, our primary source of income was from broadcasters. So if you're going into the BBC, for example, with three ideas, they pick one but reject the other two, and one of them in the UK games industry story, because the From Bedrooms to Billions name came a lot later. You don't sort of go, you bastards, or you know, or something like that, because obviously you need the work. So but we would always go back in with that, and it got to the point in the end where we were actually getting, oh, not that UK games industry story again, you know, almost as if, why do you keep trying, you know, it's not going to happen. And so it became, I think over quite a few years, it just got to this point when we just thought, right, this is getting stupid. We actually have a very near miss with the Beeb, where we finally thought we cracked it in 2009, and we thought a three-parter had been commissioned.
Right.
We were asked to I think at that point it was a six-parter, and we were asked to structure it into a three-parter. And they were going to, the idea was they were going to show it around the time Micromen was on.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we got a rejection. It got, I think it passed through several pairs of hands of people saying, love it, love it, love it. And then in the end, I think the controller of the channel just killed it, because he just said that video gaming is too niche a subject for a BBC4 audiences, which, you know, is rather ridiculous. But there's not much you can really do. You can't put a gun to the head and force them to commission it. So we then decided that we needed to look at alternate routes. And that's actually when we made the decision to move it away from broadcast, which is very different from film, because we'd actually just, we were in the process of just finishing our first motion picture, which is a movie called Burlesque Undressed. And that's that is another story of how we got involved in that, because we're not closet burlesque fans, you know, parading up and down in suspenders or anything like that. It was literally a project we were asked to do, and it ended up being released as a motion picture, and it did quite good business, and it opened quite a few doors for us. So we sort of thought, hang on a minute, you know, we've just done okay critically well with this movie. Why don't we make From Bedrooms to Billions our second film? Why don't we say not bother with TV and make it as an independent British movie, as a British film? And then that's when it truly became From Bedrooms to Billions and was a 90-minute feature film.
Tell you what, I'm really, really surprised, because I mean, just hearing you talk about this, I can hear the passion about your gaming experience and everything, and that really is going to sort of make people to actually watch this a lot more, because a lot of these films, I wouldn't say are made by gamers themselves, it's just like a little thing they do, but I can tell straight away from just hearing what you're saying that you guys are, you know, gamers.
Do you know something? Those people on the internet, the people that do, people like yourself, people that stick up films on YouTube where they're talking over the top about why they like this Commodore game or why they like this Spectrum game, they are absolutely vital. They are the people that have effectively kept this interest growing and growing and growing and growing, and why it's now we have the term retro gaming. You know, it really, it's just I think it's just a passion for games. You know, you sometimes hear it where people say, oh, I'm a retro gamer, I'm not a modern gamer. But I think it's just, you're just a gamer. I mean, I do play some modern games, but I think I fall into that category of not having the time to be able to spend on a, you know, I've got Resident Evil 6 sitting in the other room. I bought it a couple of weeks, so it's still wrapped in cellophane.
I haven't had the time to play it.
I've just not had time to play it.
They take such a huge commitment of time, them games, whereas the older games that we're playing, like we've been playing all sorts of games, haven't we, with our son. And you can just dip in for like 10, 15 minutes and then go off and do something else.
I think he's obsessed with Impossible Mission 2 at the moment.
Yeah, oh my God, yeah.
Hello everybody, this is Damien and you're listening to Retro Asylum, the best retro gaming podcast.
The thing I want to find out from you, but without giving too much away, can you tell us some of the retro legends that you have, you know, on the film?
Yeah, I certainly can. The I have to be cautious with the people that we're due to film, because as it's a documentary, when we started off, we had to convince people, because obviously we self-financed it at first to get it moving. We sort of thought in the end we'd got to make a start on this film. So I think as a few astute people realised when we started the first campaign, that we actually had started, you know, we'd already started principal photography on it. So we basically started writing to people and saying, look, we're doing this film. And at first it was difficult because obviously they want, you know, if you've got somebody that's a very successful developer and obviously you're out of the blue, you've never met them before and no one's ever done anything like this before, they're sort of thinking, is it just going to be some sort of web film that no one's ever going to see? So the first few interviews were quite important because we put those up on the web, and then it showed some of the other interviewees that we were serious about it and we were shooting on film, and we were shooting with lots of different lenses and making it look very filmic and very nice and all these types of things. And then other people started to come along. So, I mean, people that we've already filmed so far is US Gold's Jeff Brown, David Perry, Peter Harrop, Miles Jacobson, Ian Stewart, of Gremlin Graphics, Steve Wilcox from Elite, John Hare, Jeff Crammond, Jeff Minter, the Pickford Brothers, the Oliver Twins. Julian Rignall, Matthew Uffendall, Gary Bracey from Ocean, Ian Lee, just for obviously for a contribution as he's such a huge retro gaming fan.
Yeah.
David Braben, Sandy White, Ian Livingstone, Rob Hubbard, Ben Daglish, Stuart Fotheringham, Kevin
so
Toms, John Gibson.
You pretty much have everyone that is anyone in the retro gaming business, basically. So you've pretty much got everyone.
Yeah, and there's still lots more to come.
So what were some of these people like then? Who were your favourites?
Oh, I don't think I could ever say that.
They've all been absolutely fantastic.
You're basically asking somebody to give up 2 hours of their life to talk about their memories. What I will say is when you're making a documentary, you have an idea of where it may go.
Yeah.
You have an idea. You know, you don't just go into it blind. You obviously formulate your questions around that. Mm-hmm. But what has been quite eye-opening is the mid-90s.
Right.
We've really uncovered some very, very interesting, almost skullduggery to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. We've discovered some very interesting things about what happened to the UK industry in the mid-90s.
Is that something we're going to have to wait to film to watch to find out?
Most definitely. But I'll tell you that when you start to interview people and, you know, people that to a certain extent don't have contact with each other.
Yeah.
So you hear certain common denominators, certain names that come up or certain businesses or certain activities that come up. And the mid-90s was always the point when we were most interested because, well, no, actually, let me rephrase that completely. We're obviously interested in all of it. But mid-90s is where it gets quite dark and sort of murky. You can't quite people seem to get out of the industry or sell up or you know, go and work in an insurance company or whatever it may be, but the arrow of light that sort of went right through the 80s definitely got deflected all over the place in the mid 90s, and then we started to understand a lot more. But I'll tell you something else that we discovered: lots and lots of personal stories.
Right. Okay.
But you got to remember that these people, when they started off, they didn't go, "I'm going to be a pioneer." You know, they literally, it was the next logical progression. When the home computers became available, we had a lot of talent that didn't necessarily know that they were talented, that made, and I think the other thing as well is the dedication. You're talking about people that effectively started an industry genuinely from the bedroom or the spare room through enthusiastic interest, not necessarily from commercial interest. There are a couple of people we interviewed that thought, right, we can make this, will make loads of money, you know, immediately saw the business side of it from the start, but they are few and far between. It was genuinely people. I think Anthony Crowther summed it up really well when he said it wasn't about the games, it wasn't about money, it was about programming. All I wanted to do was to make this computer speak, or, you know, to basically to get it to do something and to get something up on the screen. And I think also something, it's got to do with the fact that the TV, you know, growing up in the 80s, I'm sure people my age will feel the same way. The TV was like this hallowed object. It was what was beamed into it. You couldn't alter. I mean, you could alter the volume and the, you know, make it color or black and white, but effectively you couldn't manipulate what was on that TV. The computer allowed you to do that. It allowed you to obviously put things up on the screen that you effectively had control of. And that's a common thing that we've heard from people. It was like the idea of being able to do something and get it onto the TV. And then this sort of, you know, we keep hearing this thing where suddenly people just started writing games and then gradually publishers came up. And that 82 to 85 point is very interesting where, you know, it really was a cottage industry that suddenly, wham, became a fully fledged business. And you only need to look at the PCW shows at Olympia from the, when we look at the, even just looking at the archives, and you can see how basic it was sort of 80, 81, and then 85, 86, it looked like E3, you know, with giant enormous stands, huge great logos and games everywhere. And that's how the industry really developed. And then obviously by the time you hit the mid 90s, the vast majority of it was gone. And it was like, what happened? So that's, while this is a celebration, we also want to tell the story and understand what happened, where did it go, and where are we today? Where's the UK games industry today?
Hello, this is Potty Boy,
and you're listening to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum.
The other question I wanted to find out now, like retro gaming, why has it come back so big and strong? You know, we've recently had Play Expo, and it just seems to be everywhere. All these machines, everyone seems to be talking about it. Why is it such a big deal now?
I think gaming now is arguably 40 years old, and I think that you've now got a legacy that you can look back on. You know, when something's only a few years old, it didn't exist before sort of 70s. I know this is an arguable point, by the way, but let's say 1972. Once you sort of hit sort of the mid to late 70s, gaming is so basic and early that it's just this sort of progression. We've reached a point now where we expect our AAA titles to blow our socks off and to be incredible and everything else. And now, effectively, whether you consider it a piece of art or anything else, it's been around long enough for us to look back on retrospectively, to actually look back and say, oh, look at the way games were in 1984 or 1988 or the 16-bit, the late 80s, early 90s. So it's been around long enough now for us to pick and choose and select games from different eras to enjoy. Now, whether that, you know, you could compare it almost to wine or films or music. You know, you'd be a music fan and be in the mood for the Beatles one day or for Pink Floyd the next, showing my age, or 80s music or whatever it may be. So I think that's the reason why I think retro gaming has got so big now, is because I think that we've now got a palette of games and styles and eras to choose from and look back on and discuss. Well, you know, like a piece of art. You know, and some people hate games being referred to as art, but they were created. You know, it did take skill and talent to create games of lots of different styles and amazing imagination. So maybe you could argue that they are a form of art.
Buzzbot from ArtPod and the Free Bees podcast. You're listening to the most greatest, funkiest retro gaming podcast in the world, Retro Asylum.
Alright, I've got another quick question before we round this up then. Now, I want to find out your three favourite games each then, so I'll go for Nicola then, first of all.
Oh my god.
You tell us why then.
One of my favourites actually on the Spectrum, and no one seems to have ever heard of it really, is a game called Chamber of Horrors, which I played for hours and hours and hours, and I absolutely loved it. Thought it was brilliant.
Who was that by, do you know? Because I don't think I know that one.
It's a CRL game, I seem to remember. I had to track it down. I'd never heard of the bloody thing. And Nicola was going on about it for me for ages. And it was, I think it was a CRL game, 83 or 84, probably 83. And we got it working. I got it working on the Spectrum.
Yeah.
Running. And it's actually quite addictive.
I'm going to have to check it out. I'm going to check it out on World of Spectrum. So I'll see if it's on there.
I can't find any reference to it anywhere, and I think I bought this game for about £1.50 in a local shop, and it's brilliant. It's so good, but every time I mention it to anyone, no one's heard of it. So maybe I bought the only copy that ever existed in the UK.
Maybe.
Yeah, the one copy. Yeah.
Just the one copy, you were lucky enough to have it.
And I have it, and sadly my Spectrum was broken, and
power supply
on it, so then I couldn't play it, and then Anthony found it for me, and I started playing it, and it became a bit of a control thrower again.
You did actually throw the control again.
I did. I got very involved with it. And another game that me and Anthony used to play quite a lot as well was Kickoff.
Kickoff, yes.
And we met Dino Dini. We interviewed Dino Dini a couple of weeks ago, actually.
At the Play Expo, was that Play after? Expo.
It was quite amazing to interview him there. And I think it was quite interesting to sort of meet somebody whose game you played. We did really play Kickoff 2 especially.
I became obsessed with that, yeah. Another one is Hero.
What, is that on the Atari?
That was, we used to play that on the
C64.
Oh, the C64, okay.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty good version, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three of mine.
All right, then, Anthony, what about yourself, then? Three favourite games?
Right, I'd have to probably say number one would be Paradroid. I know that sounds like a boring thing to select because everybody says that, but I just... Andrew Braybrook was an absolute genius. Well, is an absolute genius, and I thought that game was quite incredible. I think a second one would again. It's going to be Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. I have to say Hero. Actually, I think Hero. Right, was, okay. I played Hero on the C64 throughout the 80s, and I think the third one, Mercenary, Paul Wokes.
Oh, I don't think I know that one. What's that one about then?
Mercenary. Oh, it's the. It's called, the full title is actually called Mercenary Escape from Targ, or Tharg. Targ? Escape from Targ. Sorry, Paul. if you've not played it, it's absolutely fantastic. You're flying through hyperspace with your computer, Benson.
Yeah.
You come out of hypersleep, and it's a 3D wireframe game, and you crash land on the planet, and you can, you basically have to sort of, there's a war going on the planet, I think between the Palars and the Mechanoids, I seem to remember, and you can sort of play one off against the other, and there's six or seven different ways of escaping from the planet.
Yeah.
And it's just a open-ended, fantastic game. It was actually the first game I ever mapped. I think the only game I actually mapped.
Did you do that on graph paper? Or just plain paper, was it?
I think it was graph paper. I actually took that game really seriously. It was the only real game. When I was talking to Julian Rignall about it, actually, he was the same. That Mercenary was one of those games you were like, oh my God. I mean, Elite was fantastic, and that's why I always find top threes hard to do because there were sometimes I would get into a game and play it to an obsessive level. So Elite I certainly did, but nothing, I mean, really, I should move Mercenary to my number one, but I play Paradroid to obsessive levels as well.
Have you found that these games that you've mentioned then, how have you found that they've aged then, playability still there and so on?
I think that I tend to find with these games they're just very addictive. And that you can just dip in and have that little half an hour. And and for me, they just have some fantastic memories.
I think the games I think playability-wise, I think even when you were sort of 11 or 12 years old in the 80s, if a game had rubbish playability, you tended to play the games that sort of resonate with you now generally were ones you enjoyed playing, so they must have been good to play or they drew you in well. So I think that the timeless classics, you know, like Paradroid or Hero, or I think the playability is still there, and then you don't care so much about the graphics, you know.
Yeah.
you don't really, it's not all right, graphics have evolved, and you know, we see we do see some modern games on iOS where they've deliberately gone for an 8-bit style. You know, they've gone for a sort of retro-y style. But I think it's about the playability. I think that's what it always comes down to. That it's got to... I mean, obviously, we like things to look nice and sound nice and everything. And, you know, when we were interviewing Rob Hubbard, you know, Rob Hubbard would say that he was surprised to hear that people would sometimes buy his games because they had a Rob Hubbard soundtrack on them. Not necessarily because of the game itself. I'm not going to name any of the games that might have been rubbish but had a great soundtrack. But that's perhaps a different example. But I think I think certainly playability is the number one thing.
Oh no, definitely. I mean, I used to get all the games by Ben Dalglish because the music was just absolutely amazing, and anything by the Codemasters as well. You know, by the Oliver Twins.
Yep.
Which I was just a big fan of the Dizzy series, so I used to just play that non-stop, and I had the honour of interviewing them last year, and I was completely blown away. I was so shy when I talked to them.
They're lovely, aren't they? They're very nice guys.
So down to earth.
Yep.
Right, so I think we should start wrapping this up.
I'm sorry, it's just one thing that I would like to add, is that with this film, one thing that Anthony and I've always wanted it to do is to act in some way of an inspiration to young people now.
Yeah.
You know, you look back on it and it's such an important part of the UK industry, this, showing how we developed such a fantastic industry. And now, you know, we're speaking with people that are saying to us, you know, this film could be used within schools to help youngsters look at something and think, well, we could do that. Mm-hmm. We could do what these guys were doing back in the 80s. And so it's very important part for me and Anthony to have that this film will work with youngsters now and try and get them to be part of this industry.
And I'm not trying to say that, you know, we've got Union Jacks tattooed on our stomachs, but we have heard from a couple of teachers that have actually both separately, so they don't know each other, but they've both separately told us under interview that children they've been teaching would say things along the lines of, I thought all games all came from America and Japan. I didn't know there was games that ever came from the UK. Now, again, we're not obsessively trying to sort of bang the UK drum, but we can't have that.
It's an important part of our sort of like history, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So is there any thank yous or any ones you'd like to give any special mentions to?
I will say, though we're obviously still halfway through the film itself, I'd like to say thank you to Andy Payne, who has been absolutely fantastic. There have been many other people, and obviously we'll be doing a sort of proper thanks, but Andy Payne so far has been absolutely fantastic. Mastertronics, Andy Payne. In helping us, in sort of opening doors for us to get other interviewees, because it's very handy when somebody can introduce you to somebody else and say, these guys are the real deal, they're doing a proper film, come and talk to you. So we've been able to get some really good interviews lined up thanks to his introductions.
And I think also all the people that have supported our Indiegogo campaign, because without them believing in the project and putting their money in to help us go out and do the filming, obviously none of this would be possible, so a big thank you to them.
They mean a lot.
Absolutely fantastic. And you know, the support, it really is lovely when people are writing to you and saying what a good idea the film is, and helping us out with perks and offering us so many things. It's just been wonderful. And all the people that we've interviewed as well have been absolutely fantastic. You know, they've given their time, they've really opened up. I mean, we have so much footage, you know, how we're going to condense this down into a 90-minute film, that, you know, but we've got so much stuff.
We've got 200 hours now.
Well, maybe you've got enough for a sequel as well, then.
I think there might be a sequel.
Enough for George Lucas doing 9 Star Wars films. I think we could do 9 from Civilians volumes at this rate.
Well, I think Lord of the Rings has got nothing on us. Yeah.
I was going to say, you could start with some prequels as well before that.
Oh, Let There Be Light. But I think the... I should have actually said that about Indiegogo. Though, I mean, we've had people that have emailed us and donated hardware for us because obviously some of the people that we've interviewed have very graciously offered to sign stuff that we've been able to turn into perks, and the perks obviously allowed us to hit our target, and the target was obviously so we could complete principal photography on the film, which is exactly what we're doing. So it's been, you know, it doesn't matter whether someone stuck a fiver in, a pound. You know, we would get people that would stick a tenner in and say, that's all I can afford, good luck, guys. But, you know, and there were obviously people that stuck in a lot more than that, but they're all as important. They're all equally important because they believed in this enough to want to put their hand in their pocket and help us make it.
Well, okay, Anthony, Nicola, I'd just like to say thank you very much. I'm looking more forward to actually watching this movie now after speaking to you. I can't wait to see it now.
Well, that's lovely to hear that. Thank you very much indeed.